biting gently at me, and it made my knees weak. He came back up to my lips, and when he kissed me, I could taste the soap from my skin. The feel of him pressed against the front of my body, close enough that if I opened my hand, I'd be able to hold him, was overwhelming. I realized it was more than just sex. I wanted to feed off of him again, not with my teeth, but with my body. I wanted to drink in the energy of him through my skin, my bare skin pressed to his. I wanted it so badly. His hands slid over my breasts, covering them in soap, making them slick, the nipples already tight and hard. My arms slid around his waist, using the pressure of our bodies to keep the towel in place. He moved against my body, and his chest was so slick, so smooth, rubbing against my breasts. He began to walk backwards with his arms locked behind me, moving us back towards the water. My hands moved over the slick hardness of his back, sliding dangerously lower. It was as if I wanted to press every inch of myself to him, to roll his body around me like a sheet and drink him in through the pores of my skin. I opened that link with Jean-Claude and found him sitting, waiting, patient. I called for help, and distantly I heard his voice in my head.
It is all I can do, ma petite, to control my own appetites. You must control your own.
What's happening to me? Even as I asked, Micah moved his body that fraction away that allowed the towel to slide down. And when he quickly moved back, he was pressed against my groin and stomach, and it was déjà vu enough to draw a small sound out of my throat. Jean-Claude looked up, and I knew that he saw what was happening with Micah, that with a thought he could feel what was happening, as if it were his hands sliding down the slick, soaped skin. My hand slid over the thick hardness of Micah. He half collapsed against me as I caressed him, and I knew that it hadn't been my idea to touch him. Jean-Claude had wanted to know what it felt like. He drew away enough for me to move my hand, but the damage had been done. Micah dragged me into the water, surer now than ever that I would say yes. Jean-Claude's voice in my head.
You can feed off his lust, but the price for that is that you will crave his lust. His sex. It is the double-edged sword of being incubus. The sword edge I have walked for centuries.
Help me!
I cannot. You must ride this thing yourself. And you will either conquer it or be conquered. You felt what happened when I interfered just now. Because I have denied myself feeding through my body. I knew you would not approve, so I denied myself. And being inside your body while you touch him, while you feed, would be my undoing. I crave you more than you will ever crave the man in your arms. I have wanted to take your body in the way that only I could take it. To feed from your sex, not from a vein. But I knew that would frighten you more than blood.
Micah turned me towards the wall, putting my hands up against the tile, pressing his body against my back. Jean-Claude's voice was soft in my head, more intimate than Micah's touch.
I did not know you would gain this demon from me, ma petite, and nothing I can say will convince you of that. I know that. I await you here until you have wrestled the demon, whatever the outcome.
And he shielded from me. Hid himself away so he would not feel what was happening, left me alone to make my choice, if I was still capable of choosing. I found I did have a voice and said, Micah, stop, please, stop. Micah licked the back of my neck and I shuddered, pressed against the wet wall. Please, Micah, I'm not on birth control. A clear thought at last. He bit softly at the back of my neck.
I had myself fixed 2 years ago. You're safe with me, Anita.
Please, Micah. Please don't. He bit harder, just this side of drawing blood, and my body went passive, calm. It was as if he'd hit a switch I didn't know I had. When he pressed himself inside me, he was slick, and I knew that sometime when I'd been paying attention to Jean-Claude inside my head, he'd spread more soap on himself, allowing that thick hardness to slide more easily inside me. He pinned me to the wall and slid inside me, one tight inch at a time. It wasn't that he was long so much as he was wide, wide enough that it was just this side of pain to have him work himself inside me, even with the soap. He pushed until most of him was inside me, and there was a stopping point. Then he began to draw himself out slowly, so slowly. Then in again, slowly, still having to push himself, to work to make room for himself inside me. I stood pinned against the wall, passive, unmoving. It wasn't like me. I moved during sex. But I didn't want to move. Didn't want to stop, and there was no thinking, just the feel of him moving in and out of me. I wasn't as tight now, and the soap had given way to my own wetness, so that he began to move more smoothly in and out of me. He was gentle, but he was so big that even gentle was almost overwhelming. He came to the end of my body before the full shaft of him was inside me. I could feel him bumping against my cervix at the end of each stroke. Most women find having their cervix bumped painful, but some women find it pleasurable. His size was intimidating, but when I realized it didn't hurt, in fact that it felt wonderful, a part of me that was still sane, still keeping track of some safety measures, relaxed and shut down. My last measure of control went away. I didn't want sex. That was just a means to an end. I wanted to feed. I wanted to eat his lust, drink his heat, bathe in his energy. The thought brought a sound low in my throat. Micah braced himself against the wall, his body pinning mine completely, and began to find a rhythm, still gentle, but quicker. He was being so careful of me, and I didn't want him careful. I heard a voice that didn't quite sound like mine. "Harder." His voice came out squeezed tight.
"It will hurt if I do it harder."
"Try me."
"No."
"Micah, please, just do it, please. If it hurts, I'll tell you. Please." He'd been less controlled in the other room, and I realized why. He truly was afraid of hurting me because he was inside me. When he was just rubbing himself on my body, he hadn't had to worry about damaging me. Now he did. It gave him an edge of control that kept me from feeding. He was a Nimirage, and he had enough power to keep me out. Unless he let down his guard. To do that, he had to lose more control than this. Even as I thought it, a part of me was swimming to the surface. I could think again, at least a little. I didn't want to do this. I didn't want to feed off of him. It was wrong in so many ways. It was wrong. I started to say, "Micah, stop, I can't do this." I got as far as, "Micah," and he took me at my word. He thrust into me so hard and fast it tore a scream from my throat and brought that new part of me that was Jean-Claude's hunger in a raging wave of heat that rode my body and spilled out my mouth. He'd stopped.
"Are you all right?"
"Don't stop. Don't stop." He never asked again. He drove himself inside me so fast and hard that it left me gasping, unable to catch my breath. Small, helpless noises fell from my lips, spaced with the words, "Oh, God, yes, yes, Micah." Every time he thrust as far as he could, smashing himself inside me, it rode that fine line between overwhelming pleasure and pain. And just as the pleasure began to turn to pain, he'd withdraw and I'd be able to breathe again. Then he'd thrust himself inside me again, and it would start all over. It felt like he filled me up as if I were a cup, until there was nothing inside me but the feel of his body, the feel of his flesh pounding into mine. It was tight, thick, like he'd plugged a hole with his body and would never let it go. That sense of fullness inside me grew, grew and spilled over me, through me, inside me, and tore out of my mouth in ragged, frantic screams as my body spasmed around him. And it was only then that his control slipped away, letting me know that he had still been gentle. His control went when he did, and I drank him into me, through his chest pressed to my back, his hips thrusting against my butt. I drank him in as he exploded inside me. I fed on him, drew him inside every pore of my skin until it was as if our skins gave way and we spilled into each other, became for one shining moment one thing, one beast. And I could feel his beast inside me, as if they were coupling within our bodies as our human shells merged. In that moment, I didn't doubt that I was truly his Nimir-Ra. When we were finished and had slid to the floor, him still inside me, his arms hugging me to the front of his body, I started to cry. He was afraid he'd hurt me, but that wasn't it. I couldn't explain the tears to him because I didn't want to say it out loud. But I knew. I'd tried not to be one of the monsters for so long, and now, in one fell swoop, I was them. Both of them. You couldn't be a blood-sucking vampire and be a lycanthrope at the same time. They canceled each other out as a disease or a curse. But I had felt my beast curl around Micah's. I had felt it like an embryo in a safe, warm place, waiting. And I had fed off of him as surely as any vampire. I'd always thought I'd have to drink blood to be one of them. But I had been wrong. Wrong about so many things. I let Micah hold me. I felt his heart pounding against my back and wept.
12. Nathaniel drove because I was too shaky to concentrate. I was functioning, moving forward, solving the problems one at a time, but it was as if the very ground I walked on, the air I breathed, was precarious and new. As if everything had changed, because I had changed. I knew better. I knew that no matter how bad you feel or what horrible thing happens to you, that the world just keeps on going. That the rest of the world doesn't even realize that the monsters are eating your heart. A long time ago, it used to bother me that I could be in such confusion, such pain, and the world just didn't give a shit. The world, the creation as a whole, is designed to move forward, to keep on keeping on without any one individual person. It feels damned impersonal. And it is. But then if the world stopped rotating just because one of us was having a bad day, we'd all be floating out in space. So I huddled in the passenger seat of my Jeep in the late darkness and knew that only I had changed. But it was just such a big change that it felt like the world should have changed its orbit just a little. June was back to its normal, hot, sticky self. Nathaniel wore a ribbed tank top and silky jogging shorts. He'd tied his nearly ankle-length hair in a loose braid that curled on the seat beside his thigh. He'd found that if he let his hair fall onto the floorboard, sometimes it tangled around the pedals. He had to watch the gear shift between the seats, too. I'd never had hair that long. Nathaniel had only had his driver's license for a few months, even though he was 20. Gabriel, their old alpha, had not encouraged them to be independent. I sort of demanded it of them, as far as they were able. At first, Nathaniel had been lost when I started to demand that he decide things for himself, but lately he'd been doing better. It made me hopeful, and I needed some hope right now. He'd picked out the clothes that he'd brought to the makeshift hospital for me. Black jeans, royal blue scoop-neck t-shirt, a black bra that fit low enough to accommodate the low neckline, matching undies, black jogging socks, black Nikes, a short-sleeved black shirt to cover the shoulder rig with the Browning high power. People kept urging me to go shopping for a new main gun. They were probably right. There was probably something out there that would fit my hand better than the Browning. But I'd been putting it off. The Browning was like a piece of me. I felt incomplete without it, like I was missing a hand. It was going to take something more than a smaller grip to convince me to switch guns. So for now, it was still me and the Browning. Nathaniel had also brought my wrist sheaths and the matching silver knives. I was going to leave them in the car since the shirt was short-sleeved. They were a little too aggressive to wear into the police station. I had just replaced the back sheath I had ruined in New Mexico. It had been a special order, and it had cost mucho extra dinero to get a rush job on it, but it had been worth it. There really wasn't anywhere else on my body that I could carry a blade that large and still be able to sit down without the hilt showing. We drove in silence. Nathaniel hadn't even turned the radio on, which he liked to do. He rarely moved in silence if he could have music for background. But tonight he let the silence seep into the Jeep. I finally asked a question I'd been wanting an answer for. Who put the Derringer in my robe pocket? The Derringer was in the glove compartment.
I did.
Thanks.
The two things that you always do first is get dressed and get armed.
His smile flashed in an instant of streetlight.
I'm not sure which is your highest priority.
I had to smile. I'm not sure either.
How are you doing?
His voice was very careful when he asked it, quiet in the rushing silence of the car. I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
He was one of the few people that would actually take me at my word and not press. If I told Nathaniel I didn't want to talk, we didn't talk. The silence between us was no longer strained. In fact, silence with Nathaniel was one of the most relaxing sounds of my day. Nathaniel parked the Jeep and we got out. I had my executioner's license with me, and most people knew me on sight. It occurred to me that they thought I was dead. As we walked towards the door, I realized I should probably have called ahead and given them a heads up, but it was too late now. I was a yard from the door. I wasn't using the cell phone now. I was a familiar enough sight that I could usually just wave as I went past the desk, but tonight the officer's eyes got big as he waved me on to the left so I didn't have to go through the metal detector. But he was picking up a phone as he did it. I was betting he was calling ahead. You don't see people rise from the dead every night. Well, I guess I do, but most cops don't. I was up the stairs leading to Rippet's headquarters when Detective Clive Perry opened the door and started down the stairs. He was slender, handsome, African-American, and the most unfailingly polite person I'd ever met. He actually missed the step and had to catch himself on the railing. Even then, he leaned against the wall like his legs weren't working quite right. He looked shocked. No, scared.
Anita.
His voice was breathy. It was probably the second time in all the years we'd known each other that he had used my first name. It was usually Ms. Blake. I responded in kind, smiling. Clive, it's good to see you. His eyes flicked from me to Nathaniel, then back to me.
You're supposed to be.
He straightened on the stairs.
I mean, we heard.
I watched him visibly try to rally. By the time we reached the step he was on, he looked almost normal. But his next question wasn't normal.
Did you die?
I smiled, then felt the smile fade as I stared into his eyes. He was serious. I guess I did raise the dead for a living, so the question wasn't as ridiculous as it sounded, but I was realizing that some of his shock wasn't just from seeing me walking around. It was from his fear of what I was now. He thought I was the walking dead. In some ways, he was closer to the mark than was comfortable. In others, he was so far off. No, Clive, I didn't die. He nodded, but there was a tightness around his eyes that made me wonder. If I tried to touch his arm, would he flinch? I didn't want to find out, so Nathaniel and I just walked past him, leaving him alone on the stairs. I pushed into the squad room with its crowded desks and the busy clatter of people. Rippet had some of its busiest hours after 3 a.m. The noise died gradually like fading water rings, going out into the room, until I moved in silence between the desks and the staring faces.
Nathaniel stayed at my back, moving like an attractive shadow. I finally said, loud enough to carry through the room, "The rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated." And the room exploded into noise. I was suddenly surrounded by men and a few women hugging me, slapping me on the back, pumping my hand. Smiling faces, relieved eyes. No one else showed the reservations that Clive Perry had shown on the stairs, and it made me wonder about his religious background, or his metaphysical one. He wasn't a sensitive, but that didn't mean he hadn't grown up around people who were. It was Zerbrowski who picked me completely off the ground in a huge bear hug. He's only 5'8", and not that big, but he spun me around the room, finally putting me down, laughing and a little unsteady on my feet.
"Damn, Anita. Damn. I thought we were never going to see you come through that door again."
He pushed a tangle of dark curls that were beginning to streak with gray from his forehead. He needed a haircut, but then he usually did. His clothes were the usual mismatch, as if he'd chosen his tie and shirt in the dark. He dressed like he was either colorblind or didn't give a shit. I was betting on the latter. "It's good to see you, too. I hear you're actually holding someone on suspicion of having killed me." His smile faded around the edges.
"Yeah, Count Dracula's in a cell."
"Can you get him out? Because as you see, I am very much alive." Zerbrowski's eyes narrowed.
"I saw the pictures, Anita. You were covered in blood."
I shrugged. His eyes became cool, suspicious cop eyes.
"It's been what, 4 nights? You're looking positively spry for suffering that much blood loss."
I could feel my own face grow neutral, distant, as cool and unreadable as any cop's. "Can you get Jean-Claude out and ready to go? I'd like to take him home before it gets light."
"Dolph's going to want to talk to you before you leave."
"I thought he might. Can you please start processing Jean-Claude while I talk to Dolph?"
"You going to take him to your house?"
"I'm going to drop him off at his place, not that it's any of your business. You're my friend, Zerbrowski, not my dad."
"I've never wanted to be your dad, Anita. That's Dolph's delusion, not mine."
I sighed. "Yeah." I looked up at Zerbrowski. "Will you please get Jean-Claude ready to go?" He looked at me for a second or two, then nodded.
"Okay."
He looked past me to Nathaniel, who had moved to the side of the room to let the great reunion take place.
"Who's that?"
"Nathaniel, a friend." He looked back at me.
"A little young, isn't he?"
"He's only 6 years younger than I am, Zerbrowski, but he drove me tonight so I wouldn't have to." His eyes looked worried.
"You okay?"
"A little shaky, but it'll pass." He touched my face, staring into my eyes, trying to read them, I think.
"I'd like to know what the hell is going on with you."
I met his gaze. Face, eyes blank. So would I. That seemed to surprise him, because he blinked and dropped his hand.
"I'll get Count Dracula out of hock. You go talk to Dolph."
My shoulders hunched a little and I had to concentrate to square them. I was not looking forward to talking with Dolph. Zerbrowski went to get Jean-Claude, and I left Nathaniel talking to a nice enough-seeming policewoman and went to Dolph's office. He was standing in the doorway like a small mountain. He's 6'8", and built like a pro wrestler. His dark hair was cut very short, leaving his ears stranded and bare. His suit looked pressed, tie neatly knotted. He'd probably already been on the job for nearly an 8-hour shift, but he still looked fresh out of the box. His eyes were very careful when they looked at me.
"I'm glad you're alive."
"Thanks, me too." He waved a hand and walked me down the hallway away from the office, away from the desks, towards the interrogation rooms. I guess he wanted privacy. Privacy that even the glass windows of his office wouldn't give him. It made my stomach tight and a little trickle of fear go through me. I wasn't afraid of Dolph the way I was afraid of a rogue shapeshifter or a vamp I had to kill. He wouldn't hurt me physically. But I was afraid of the tight set of his shoulders, the cautious, cold look of his eyes when he glanced back to make sure I was following. I could feel how angry he was,
almost like the energy off a shapeshifter. What had I done to deserve such rage? Dolph held the door for me, and I squeezed past his bulk.
"Have a seat,"
he said as he closed the door behind us. "I'll stand, thanks. I want to get Jean-Claude out of here before dawn."
"I heard you weren't dating him anymore,"
Dolph said. "He's being held without charge on suspicion of killing me. I'm not dead, so I'd like to get him out of here." Dolph just looked at me, eyes as cold and unreadable as if he were looking at a witness. No, a suspect that he didn't like much. "Jean-Claude has a damn fine lawyer. How'd you keep him for over 72 hours without a charge?" I asked.
"You're a city treasure. I told everyone he'd killed you, and they helped me lose him for a while."
"Damn, Dolph. You're lucky some overzealous officer didn't put him in a cell with a window."
"Yeah, too bad."
I just stared at him, not even sure what to say. "I'm alive, Dolph. He didn't hurt me."
"Who did?"
It was my turn to give him cool cop eyes. He walked up to me, towering over me. He wasn't trying to intimidate me with his height. He knew that didn't work anyway. He was just that big. He touched my chin, tried to turn my face to the side. I jerked away.
"You've got scars on your neck that you didn't have a week ago. They're all shiny and nearly healed. How?"
"Would you believe I'm not sure?"
"No."
"Suit yourself."
"Let me see the scars."
I swept my hand to one side and let him trace one large finger down the healed wounds.
"I want to see the rest of the wounds."
"Don't we need a female officer in here for this?"
"Do you really want anyone else to see them?"
He had a point. "Why do you want to see, Dolph?"
"I can't force you to show me, but I need to see them."
"Why?"
"I don't know,"
he said, and his voice showed strain for the first time. I shed the outer shirt and laid it on the table. I held my left arm out to him, pushing the sleeve of the t-shirt up. He traced his finger over the marks.
"What is it about your left arm? It's always where you get hit the most."
"I think it's because I'm right-handed. I'll let them chew on my left arm while I grab a weapon with my right."
"Did you kill what did this to you?"
"No." He looked at me, and the anger showed for a second.
"I wish I believed you."
"Me too, especially since I'm telling the truth."
"Who or what did this to you, Anita?"
I shook my head. "It's been taken care of."
"Damn it, Anita, how can I trust you when you won't talk to me?"
I shrugged.
"Is the arm all of it?"
"Almost."
"I want to see all of it."
There were a lot of men in my life that I'd have accused of just wanting to get my shirt off, but Dolph wasn't one of them. There'd never been that kind of tension between us. I stared at him, hoping he'd back down, but he didn't. I should have known he wouldn't. I worked the shirt out of my pants and exposed my bra. I had to raise the edge of the underwire to show the round hole, now scar, over my heart. He touched it like he had all the others, shaking his head.
"It's like something tried to scoop your heart out."
He raised his eyes to my face.
"How the hell did you heal it, Anita?"
"Can I get dressed?" There was a knock at the door, and Zebrowski entered without waiting to be asked, while I was still struggling to get my breasts back behind the underwire. His eyes widened.
"Am I interrupting?"
"We're finished," I said.
"Gee, and I thought Dolph would have more staying power."
We both glared at him. He grinned.
"Count Dracula is processed and ready to go."
"His name is Jean-Claude."
"Whatever you say."
I had to bend over and rearrange my breasts so the bra would fit right again. Those underwires hurt if they ride up. They both watched me do it, and I stubbornly wouldn't turn away. Zebrowski watched because he was a cheerful lech. Dolph because he was angry.
"Would you take a blood test?"
he asked. "No."
"We can get a court order."
"On what grounds? I haven't done anything wrong, Dolph, except show up here not dead. If I didn't know better, I'd say you were disappointed."
"I'm glad you're alive,"
he said.
But sorry you can't bust Jean-Claude's ass, isn't that it? He looked away. I'd finally hit on it. That's it, isn't it? You're sorry that you can't arrest Jean-Claude. Get him executed. He didn't kill me, Dolph. Why do you want him dead?
He's already dead, Anita. He just doesn't know enough to lie down.
Is that a threat? Dolph made a low, exasperated sound.
He's a walking corpse, Anita.
I know what Jean-Claude is, Dolph. Probably better than you do.
So I keep hearing,
he said. What, you're angry because I'm dating him? You are not my father, Dolph. I can date who or what I want to date.
How can you let him touch you?
And the anger was there again. Rage. You want him dead because he's been my lover? I couldn't keep the surprise out of my voice. He wouldn't meet my eyes. You're not jealous of me, Dolph. I know that for a fact. It just bothers you that he's not human, is that it?
He's a vampire, Anita.
He met my gaze then.
How can you fuck a corpse?
The level of animosity was too personal, too intimate. And then it hit me. What woman in your life is fucking the undead, Dolph? He took a step towards me, his entire body trembling, his huge hands balled into fists. The rage rushed up his face in a near purple wave. He spoke through gritted teeth.
Get out!
I wanted to say something to make it better, but there was nothing to say. I moved carefully past him, keeping my eyes on him, afraid he'd make a grab for me. But he just stood there, regaining control of himself. Zabrowski walked me out and closed the door behind us. If I'd been with another woman, we'd have talked about what just happened. If I'd been with a lot of men in a different line of work, we'd have talked about it. But Zabrowski was a cop. And that meant you didn't talk about the personal stuff. If you accidentally learned something truly painful, truly private, you left it the fuck alone. Unless the man involved wanted to talk about it. Besides, I didn't know what to say. I didn't want to know that Dolph's wife was cheating on him with a corpse. He had two sons, no daughters, so who else could it be? Zabrowski walked me through the squad room in silence. A man turned as we entered the room. He was tall, dark-haired, with gray starting at the temples. The clean, strong lines of his face were beginning to soften around the edges, but it was still a handsome face, in a manly man, Marlboro sort of way. He looked vaguely familiar. But it wasn't until he turned his head, exposing the claw scars on the side of his neck, that I recognized him. Orlando King had been one of the premier bounty hunters in the country until a rogue shapeshifter had nearly killed him. The stories could never agree on what animal did it. Some said wolf, others bear or leopard. The story had grown in the telling until I doubt anyone but King himself knew the truth. King and the shapeshifters that had nearly killed him, if they hadn't all died in the attempt, that is. He had a rep that he never lost a bounty, never stopped until his creature was dead. He earned good money lecturing across the country and in other countries. For his finale, he'd take his shirt off and show his scars. It smacked a little too much of circus sideshow for my taste, but hey, it wasn't my body. He also did some consulting with the police.
Anita Blake, this is Orlando King, Zabrowski said. We brought him in to help convict Count Dracula of your murder.
I glared at Zabrowski, who only smiled wider. He'd keep calling Jean-Claude by his pet names until it stopped getting a rise out of me. The quicker I ignored it, the better.
Ms. Blake,
Orlando King said in the deep, rolling voice that I remembered from his lectures.
So good to see you alive.
It's good to be alive, Mr. King. Last I heard, you were lecturing on the West Coast. I hope you didn't interrupt your tour to come solve my murder. He shrugged, and there was something about the way he moved his shoulders that made him seem taller, broader than he was.
There are so few of us that truly pit ourselves against the monsters. How could I not come?
I'm flattered, I said. I've heard you lecture.
You came up and spoke to me afterwards,
he said. I'm flattered again. You must meet thousands of people a year. He smiled and touched my left arm, ever so lightly.
But not many with scars to rival mine, and none half so pretty in this line of business.
Thanks. He was at least two generations removed from me, so I figured his complimenting me wasn't so much flirting as habit. Zebrowski was grinning at me, and his grin said he didn't think King was simply being polite. I shrugged and ignored it. I've found that if you pretend not to notice that a man is flirting with you, most of them will eventually grow tired and stop.
It's good to meet you again, Miss Blake, especially alive. But I know that you must be in a hurry if you're going to rescue your vampire boyfriend before dawn.
There was the faintest hesitation before the word boyfriend. I studied his face and found it neutral. There was no condemnation, nothing but a smile and goodwill. After Dolph's little fit, it was kind of nice. Thank you for understanding.
I'd love a chance to talk to you before I leave town, he said.
Again, I wondered if he was flirting, and I said the only thing I could think of. Compare notes, you mean?
Exactly,
he said. I just did not understand my effect on men. I wasn't that attractive, or maybe I just couldn't see it. We shook hands, and he didn't hold my hand any longer than necessary, didn't squeeze it or any of those funky things men do when they're interested. Maybe I was just getting paranoid where men were concerned. Zebrowski led me through the sea of desks to fetch Nathaniel. The policewoman, Detective Jessica Arnett, one of the newest members of the squad, was still entertaining Nathaniel at her desk. She was gazing into his lilac eyes as if there was some hypnotic power in them. There wasn't, but Nathaniel was a good listener. That's rare enough in men for it to be a bigger selling point than an attractive body. Come on, Nathaniel, we've got to go. He stood instantly, but tossed a smile towards Detective Arnett that made her eyes sparkle. Nathaniel's real-life job was as a stripper, so he flirted instinctively. He seemed both aware and unaware of his effect on women. When he concentrated, he understood what he was doing. But when he simply walked into a room and heads turned, he was oblivious. I touched his arm. Say goodbye to the nice detectives. We've got to hurry. He said,
goodbye, nice detectives.
I gave him a small push towards the doors. Zebrowski followed us out. I think if Nathaniel hadn't been with us, he'd have asked more questions. But he'd never met Nathaniel and wasn't sure of him. So we moved in silence to the prisoner processing where Jean-Claude was sitting on one of the three chairs. Normally, the processing area was full of people coming in, going out, and since it's the size of a walk-in closet, that makes it seem crowded. The two vending machines took up room, but except for the prisoner processing clerk, the new name since turnkey fell out of fashion, behind his little barred bank teller window, the place was deserted. But it was 3:30 in the morning. Jean-Claude rose when he saw me. His white shirt was stained, torn on one sleeve. He didn't look like he'd been beaten or hurt, but he was usually a fanatic about his clothes. Only something drastic would have changed that. A struggle, perhaps? I did not run to him, but I did wrap my arms around him, press my ear to his chest, hold on to him as if he were the last solid thing in the world. He stroked my hair and murmured to me in French. I understood enough to know he was glad to see me and that he thought I looked beautiful. But beyond that, it was just pretty noise. It wasn't until I felt Zebrowski behind me that I pulled away, but when Jean-Claude's hand found mine, I welcomed it. Zebrowski was looking at me as if he'd never seen me before. What? It came out hostile.
I've never seen you be that soft with anyone before.
It startled me. You've seen me kiss Richard before. He nodded.
That was lust. This is...
He shook his head, glancing up at Jean-Claude, then back to me.
He makes you feel safe.
I realized with a jolt that he was right. You're smarter than you look, Zebrowski.
Katie reads self-help books to me.
I just look at the pictures.
He touched my right hand.
I'll talk to Dolph.
I don't think it's going to help, I said. He shrugged.
If Orlando King can have a conversion experience where the monsters are concerned, anybody can.
What do you mean? I asked.
Have you ever read or seen any of his interviews before his accident?
Zebrowski made little quote marks with his fingers when he said accident. No. That was before I was interested in the topic, I think. He frowned at me.
I keep forgetting you were still in diapers then.
I just shook my head. So tell me.
King was one of the shining lights behind trying to get lycanthropes declared non-human, so they could be executed just for existing without a trial. Then he got cut up, and lo and behold, he mellowed.
Nearly dying will do that to you, Zebrowski. He grinned at me.
It didn't make me a better man.
I'd held my hands over his stomach, kept his insides from spilling out while we waited for an ambulance. It had happened just before Christmas, about 2 years ago. Zebrowski, alive and well, had been all I put on my list to Santa that year. If Katie couldn't make you a better man, then nothing could, I said. He grinned wider, then his face sobered.
I'll talk to the boss for you, see if I can get him to mellow without a near-death experience.
I looked up into his serious face. Just because you saw me hug Jean-Claude?
Yeah.
I gave Zebrowski a quick hug. Thank you. He pushed me back towards Jean-Claude.
Better get him under wraps before dawn.
He looked past me to the vampire.
Take care of her.
Jean-Claude gave a small bow from his neck.
I will take care of her as much as she allows it.
Zebrowski laughed.
Oh, he does know you.
We left with Zebrowski laughing, the clerk staring, and the night growing soft around us. Dawn was coming, and I had so many questions. Nathaniel drove. Jean-Claude and I rode in back. 13. I buckled my seatbelt out of habit, but Jean-Claude stayed pressed to my side, arm around my shoulders. I'd started to shake and couldn't seem to stop. It was as if I'd been waiting for him so I could finally fall apart. I didn't cry, just let him hold me while I shook.
It is all right, ma petite. We are both safe now.
I shook my head against the stained front of his shirt. It's not that. He touched my face, raised it to look at him in the soft lighted darkness of the car.
Then what is it?
I had sex with Micah. I watched his face, waited for the anger, jealousy, something to flash through his eyes. What I saw was sympathy, and I didn't understand it.
You are like a vampire, newly risen. Even those of us who will be masters cannot fight our hunger the first night, or the first few nights. It is overwhelming. It is why many vampires feed on their nearest kin when they first rise. It is who they are thinking of in their hearts, and they are drawn to them. It is only with the aid of a master vampire that the hunger can be directed elsewhere.
You're not angry? I asked. He laughed and hugged me.
I thought you would be angry with me for giving you the ardeur, the fire, the burning hunger.
I pushed back enough to see his face. Why didn't you warn me that I couldn't control it?
I never underestimate you, ma petite. If anyone I have ever known in all these centuries could have withstood such a test, it was you. So I did not tell you you would fail, because I no longer try to predict what power will do to you, or through you. You are a law unto yourself so much of the time.
I was helpless. I didn't want to control it.
Of course not.
I shook my head. Is the ardeur permanent?
I do not know.
How long until I can control it?
A few weeks. But even after you have control, You will have to be careful around those you most lust after. They will make the hunger flare like fire raging in your veins. There is no shame to it.
So you say. He held my face between his hands.
Ma petite, it has been over 400 years since I first woke with the ardour raging in me. But I remember. All these years, and I still remember that the cry for flesh was almost worse than the cry for blood.
I held his wrists, pressed his hands against my face. I'm scared.
Of course you are. You should be. But I will help you through this. I will be your guide. It may pass away in a few days or come and go. I simply do not know. But I will help you through it, whatever happens.
Nathaniel pulled into the Circus of the Damned parking lot beside the back door. It was still dark as we got out, but the air had that soft feel of pre-dawn. You could taste the coming morning on the tip of your tongue. Jason opened the outer door as if he'd been waiting for us. He probably had. Jean-Claude hurried past him to the door that led to the stairs. We followed, but Jean-Claude called back over his shoulder.
I must shower before dawn.
With that, he left us, running in a blur of motion. The rest of us walked more sedately down the stairs, able to walk 3 abreast because none of us were large people.
How are you feeling?
Jason asked. I shrugged. I'm pretty much healed.
You look shook.
I shrugged again.
Okay, I can take a hint. You don't want to talk about it?
No, I don't. Jason glanced around me at Nathaniel.
You staying the night?
Am I?
I knew the question was directed at me.
Sure.
You may need to drive me home tomorrow, or rather later today.
Yes, I am staying.
You can bunk with me then. God knows the bed is big enough and doesn't see many visitors.
I glanced at Jason. Does Jean-Claude limit your social activities? He laughed.
No, not exactly. But the women who come down here are vampire freaks. They want to sleep in a bed under the ground at the Circus of the Damned. They don't want me. They want Jean-Claude's pet werewolf.
I wouldn't think... I stopped myself because I realized it was an insult.
Go ahead and say it.
I wouldn't think that you'd be that picky, I said.
I wasn't when I first got here. But lately, I just don't want to be with someone who just wants me so she can brag to her friends that she slept with a shapeshifter or got to sleep where the vampires sleep. No matter how good it feels for a few minutes, it still makes me feel like they've just come to look at one of the freaks.
I slipped my arm through his, squeezed his arm. Don't let anybody make you feel like that, Jason. You're not a freak. He patted my hand.
Look who's talking.
I pulled away from him. What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing. I'm sorry I said it.
No, I want you to explain it. He sighed and hurried down the steps, but I was in Nikes and could keep up. Nathaniel followed a few steps behind without saying a word.
Explain it, Jason.
You hate the monsters. You hate being different.
That's not true.
You accept that you're different, but you don't like it.
I opened my mouth to argue with him, but had to stop myself. Had to think. Was he right?
Was he? Did I hate being different?
Did I hate the monsters because they were different? Maybe you're right. He looked back at me, eyes wide.
Anita Blake admitting she may be wrong? Gasp!
I tried to frown at him, but I could feel it held an edge of a smile that ruined the effect. I better get used to being one of the monsters, or so I hear. His eyes went serious.
Are you really going to be a were-leopard?
We'll find out, won't we?
You okay with it?
It was my turn to laugh, but it sounded bitter.
No. No, I'm not okay with it, but the damage is done. I can't change it.
Fatalism, he said.
Practicality, I said.
Same thing,
he said.
No, it isn't.
Jason looked past me at Nathaniel, who treaded softly a few steps behind me.
How do you feel about her being a were-leopard?
I think I'll keep my feelings to myself.
You're happy about it, aren't you?
and there was an edge of hostility in his voice.
No, I'm not. You get to keep her as your Nimir-Ra now. Maybe. Doesn't that make you happy?
Stop it, Jason. Richard's told me his little theory about Gregory marking me on purpose.
You talked to Richard?
He made it a question. Unfortunately.
You know what's happened, then?
About you guys taking Gregory? Yeah. I talked to Jacob on the phone, even. Jason looked surprised.
What did you say to him?
Gregory dies, Jacob dies.
Jacob wants to be Ulfric.
We discussed that, too, I said.
What did he say?
He won't challenge Richard until after the full moon this month. You better give Sylvia a heads up, because that means Jacob has to defeat her within the next 2 weeks.
Why is he waiting for the full moon?
Because I told him I'd kill him if he didn't.
You can't undercut Richard's authority like that.
I don't need to, Jason. He's doing such a good job all on his own. We were at the bottom of the stairs, the heavy door hanging open where Jean-Claude had rushed through.
Richard is my Ulfric.
I'm not asking you to badmouth him, Jason. He's destroyed his power structure within the pack. It's not something to debate, it's just the truth. Jason stopped me at the door.
Maybe if you had been here, you could have talked him out of it.
I was finally angry. One, you have no right to question what I do or don't do. Two, Richard is a big boy and makes his own decisions. Three, don't you ever, ever question me again.
You're not my Lupa anymore, Anita.
Anger flared through me like a scalding wave, tightening my shoulders, my arms, spilling into my hands. I'd never felt rage so quickly and so completely. I had to close my eyes to concentrate so I wouldn't take a swing at him. What was wrong with me? I felt Nathaniel at my back.
Are you all right?
He said. I shook my head. I don't think so.
Look, Jason said, I'm sorry, but I don't want Jacob in charge of the pack. I don't trust him. Richard may be a bleeding heart, flag-waving right-winger, but he's also fair, and he really does try to put the best interests of the pack before his own. I don't want to lose that.
I looked at him, trying to swallow past the anger. My voice came out squeezed tight. You're scared about what will happen to all of you if Jacob takes over. He nodded.
Yes.
Me too, I said. He looked into my face, studied it.
If Jacob kills Richard in a fair fight, what will you do?
Richard isn't my boyfriend anymore, and I'm not Lupa. If it's a fair challenge fight, then I can't interfere. I told Jacob if the fight was fair and after the full moon, I wouldn't take revenge on him.
You won't avenge Richard's death?
If I kill Jacob and Richard and Sylvia are already dead, who will take over? I've seen what happens to a group of shapeshifters who don't have an alpha to lead them. I won't let what happened to the leopards happen to the wolves.
If Jacob died before he fought Sylvie, then you wouldn't have to worry about it,
Jason said. The anger that had been leaking away made a comeback. You can't have it both ways, Jason. Either I'm not your Lupa, not dominant to you, and thus can't help you fix this, or I am still your Lupa, still dominant to you, still someone you come to for this kind of help. Make up your mind which you want me to be before you get up in my face again.
You can't be Lupa. The pack voted you out. But you're right, it's not your fault. You had to try and fix yourself before you could fix anyone else. I'm sorry I got in your face.
Apology accepted, I said. I started to go around him through the door, but he caught my arm.
I didn't ask you to kill Jacob because you were my Lupa or dominant to me. I asked you because I know you've already thought of it. I asked you because I know if you think it's best for the pack, you'll do it.
Pack business is no longer my concern, so everyone keeps telling me.
They don't know you like I do,
he said. I pulled away from him gently. What's that supposed to mean?
It means that once you've given your friendship, your protection to someone, you take care of them, even if they don't want you to.
If I kill Jacob, Richard will never forgive me.
He dumped you, right? What have you got to lose by killing Jacob? Nothing. But if you don't kill him, then you lose Sylvie and Richard.
I pushed past him. I am getting really tired of doing everyone's dirty work.
No one is better at dirty work than you are, Anita.
That stopped me, made me turn back around to face him. What's that supposed to mean?
It doesn't mean anything. It's just the truth.
I stared into his so solemn eyes. I would have liked to argue, but I really couldn't. I'd thought I couldn't feel worse about myself tonight. I'd been wrong. Watching the look in Jason's eyes, hearing him talk about me like that, made me feel worse. This night just couldn't get any more depressing. 14. Dawn was minutes away when Jean-Claude came through the door in a robe.
You may have the bed, ma petite, and I will take my coffin. I think your nerves are raw enough without me dying in your arms as the sun rises.
I'd have liked to argue, because I wanted him to hold me in the worst way, but he was right. I'd had enough shocks for one night. Nathaniel will stay with me, I said. A look passed over Jean-Claude's face.
And Jason as well.
Why?
I do not have the time to explain, ma petite, but please trust me that Jason should be here too. It is for the best.
I could feel Dawn trembling close, even so deep underground. Okay. Jason can stay too. Jean-Claude was already edging out the door.
I will tell him on my way to the coffin room. I am sorry to leave you like this, ma petite.
Go, it's almost dawn, I said. He blew me a kiss, then was gone, leaving the door slightly ajar. Nathaniel was sitting on the corner of the bed, neutral in face, eyes, even body language. He was very good at seeming non-threatening, soothing almost. I'd been sleeping off and on for almost 4 days, yet I was tired, unbelievably tired. I wasn't sure it was physical, more like I'd overused my mind, my emotions. I was wrung out. Let's get some sleep. He pulled off his tank top without another word, kicked off his shoes, pulled off his socks, and began to unbraid his hair. I knew that would take a while, so I went into the bathroom while he finished. It had been a long time since I'd seen Jean-Claude's bathroom, with its fancy black tub that was big enough for a small orgy. The silver swan that the water came out of always reminded me of a fountain. But no bath tonight. I just wanted to sleep and to forget. Forget everything. Of course, I hadn't come away with jammies, and the shirt that Nathaniel had picked for me, though attractive and comfortable, was not long enough to be a sleep shirt. I could not sleep in jeans. It just wasn't comfortable. Damn, why should the small things be so important on a night when all the big things had gone to hell? There was a knock on the bathroom door. I'll be out in a minute, Nathaniel.
It's Jason.
What do you want?
Didn't Jean-Claude tell you that I was bunking with you tonight?
He mentioned it.
He also sent me with pajamas for you. He figured you didn't pack an overnight case.
That got me to the door and opening it. Jason stood there in a pair of blue silk boxers, baggy enough to be acceptable as sleepwear. Acceptable for him to wear while sharing a bed with me, I might add. Jason, left to his own devices, wore men's bikini underwear, or less, to bed. He held out a folded piece of red satin. I took it and let it spill through my hands. It was actually two pieces, a loose top with spaghetti straps and a pair of shorts. It was obviously meant to be lingerie.
He said to tell you that of anything he had that would fit you, it covered the most, end quote,
Jason said. I sighed. Thanks, Jason. I'll be right out. I closed the door without waiting for a reply. The top that had looked loose actually clung pretty tightly across my breasts. You'd certainly know whether I was cold or not. The shorts were cut so high on the sides that the legs almost met the waistband. It managed to cover everything and still not leave much to the imagination. Lingerie design at its best, I suppose. I opened the door and turned off the bathroom light as I came out. Jason was already tucked into the covers on the right side of the bed. Nathaniel was still sitting on the other side. He got up as I came out, his unbound hair floating around him like a living curtain.
My turn,
he said softly, turning on the bathroom light and closing the door.
You look wonderful,
Jason said. No compliments, Jason. I'm uncomfortable enough in the lingerie.
Then by all means, take it off.
I frowned at him. He patted the bed beside him, grinning at me.
Come to bed.
Piss me off enough and I'll send you back to your room.
Jean-Claude told me to stay here.